Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members Teresa and Linda, are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Hi, I'm Tim Kennelty.
And I'm Gene Thomas.
And welcome to Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. Gene, we have Catherine Schneider back, our resident bird expert. She's an ornithologist, and she's the author of Birding the Hudson Valley. Isn't that cool? Welcome, Catherine.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
Catherine has agreed to come with us and be grilled about 101 questions. We're trying to represent ourselves, usually accurately, as people who don't know diddly about birding.
Is that what the 101 series is, the diddly? I
the
like
diddly,
that.
Yes. We're going to have a whole diddly series.
So, yeah, so this is part of our 101 series, and a lot of people are really interested in birds. I know I go out in my garden and look at birds, but I don't consider myself a birder. So we're going to talk about all of that. We have lots of questions for Catherine today, don't we?
That's right. We want to know if we need a whole bunch of gear and a whole bunch of books and all kinds of funny things to wear out in the woods with other groups while we're looking at birds.
So let's start with a really basic question. What's the difference between, I think, somebody like me who's a bird watcher and somebody who's a birder?
Well, Tim, I think it has to do with your level of passion for seeing birds and maybe your image as well. A bird watcher generally is a person that notices birds like you do, but a birder actually goes out and seeks them out and goes places beyond their yard and feeder to see birds. A bird is willing to get up early because birds are up and more visible early in the morning. And birders keep lists and data. We love our lists, our life lists, our yard lists, our county lists. Birders also tend to have lots of toys. We tend to have binoculars at a minimum, but also things like spotting scopes and other gear. And birders might be considered a little weird. Actually, we're embarrassing to our children. We do things like wear our binoculars into public places. We dress a little funny because we actually go out in the field. We tuck our pants into our socks. And by wearing our binoculars in public, we kind of say we're just not embarrassed to be bird watchers or birders.
So you're showing off.
Well, not really. We're just doing what's practical for our avocation.
Okay, so what do we need to start to learn about birds and upgrade our status?
Well, number one is you got to be interested. If you don't notice birds, you're never going to be a serious birder. But then beyond that, I think you actually need a pair of binoculars that are appropriate for bird watching. And you probably need some kind of an identification guide. In the olden days, it used to be a field guide, but nowadays, a lot of people are using phone apps to identify birds.
So, in other words, I need to get off the sofa, get a pair of binoculars to start qualifying as a birder. Is that right?
You could probably be a birder to some extent from your sofa, but you're not a serious birder if you're still sitting in your
sofa. So I have a pair of binoculars, but I don't know if they're right for birding. Is there a particular type of binocular? Is there a certain level of lens that I need to be a birder?
Well, this is one of the fundamental questions that I get all the time. Birders need binoculars that are meant for birding. Problem is the binoculars are made for lots of different purposes. They're meant to make them for sporting events. They make them for watching opera. So getting a pair of binoculars that's appropriate for birding is kind of a first step. So binoculars have numbers on them. They have different levels of magnification. Something like if you look closely, you'll see it might be 7x35 or 10x42. That first number is the magnification. So if you want to go birding, I would suggest getting something with a 7, 8, or 10x magnification. And I honestly think for beginners, 7 or 8 is best.
Why is 7 or 8 best for beginners?
Well, without getting too nerdy, there's a relationship between magnification and the field of view. That is the area that you see through the binoculars. And the higher the magnification, the smaller the field of view.
Okay.
So more magnification, you're not actually going to see as much, which is actually harder because birds move around. You want to keep them in your field of view. When birds move, it's good to have a bigger field and maybe a lower magnification. You might not even notice the difference between 8 and 10 magnification, but you certainly would notice the difference in the field of view.
Let me see if I can summarize this for myself. The higher number is not necessarily better if I'm a beginning birder, because I'm probably not going to be so experienced at kind of finding something and having a smaller field of view. Is that
That's basic? Right.
Mm-hmm. Huh, interesting. Okay.
So the number, now when you first talked about the 7X, 35 and 10x 42. What are the numbers after the x?
That second number is actually, it's the distance across the objective lens, which is the lenses away from your eyes, in millimeters. So binoculars have two lenses, the oculars that are close to your eyes and the objectives that are farther away. So that second number is the distance measuring across the objective lens in millimeters. And why does 35 millimeters or 42 millimeters matter? Well, it's because it lets in more light. The bigger the objective lens, the more light. Brightness matters in binoculars because anything that is not reaching your eye is not helping you see the birds. So bigger objective lens is good. It also adds weight to your binoculars, so that's something to keep in mind. Also, I think it's important to try and get binoculars that are fully coated. Binoculars come with anti-reflective coatings on them. That's what makes them look kind of purple when you hold them up to the light, and that reduces the reflection, and that means more light gets to your eyes. So brightness is important because we use our binoculars in low-light situations, early in the morning, in the woods, for example, in shade. So the more light that can get to your eyes, the better. Another thing that I think is sort of important in choosing binoculars is to consider whether you wear eyeglasses when you were in the field. A lot of them nowadays come with adjustable eye cups, and that allows you to change the distance between that ocular lens and your eye. If you're not wearing glasses and you hold the binoculars up, there's a certain distance between your eye and that lens. But if you're wearing glasses, it holds it away. So being able to screw down the eye cups and put that distance back to normal for what it would be if you weren't wearing glasses actually helps with the field of view. If you don't have the ability to screw down that lens and adjust the distance between your eye and the ocular lens, then you don't have as good a field of view.
And is it pretty clear when you're looking online? I'm on Amazon now and looking whether it has that or not.
It should say it in the specs.
Okay.
I'd also look for waterproofing and armoring. That's a nice feature. It's not absolutely necessary. But once you drop your binoculars out of the canoe, it's costly to have them repaired.
I don't know if I'm getting in the canoe, first of all. But so if you do drop them and they're not waterproof, you've ruined them? Is that basically?
Well, no, but you have to pay somebody to take them apart, usually. I've never been successful in getting the water out by putting them on a lamp or heating them or anything. There's just always some moisture inside, and it makes it foggy.
Is there a particular brand that you think is better than others, or is that just, it really depends on all these things?
You get what you pay for with binoculars. I mean, you can buy binoculars. My binoculars, since I'm old and want the penultimate binoculars now, were close to $2,000. But you can get a decent pair of binoculars for bird watching for $350 or something like that, new, that is, right off the shelf. But the better thing to do is to shop the yard sales. I have found perfectly good binoculars for $10 at a yard sale, or go online and get something used. It's very easy to get used binoculars, and if you're persistent and keep looking and know exactly what you want, you can get them for much, much less money.
And where am I doing that? On eBay or someplace like that? Is that where
you go? Or things like FreeCycle or Buy Nothing for the county. There are lots of secondhand places to buy things. Penny Saver type magazines and those sorts of things.
And so you can get something less than $300 if you're
looking for used. Oh, definitely. You know, so many of us started out with binoculars that were given to us secondhand by grandparents and things like that. And nowadays, our grandparents have really nice binoculars because they're like me.
I'm going to go find my granddaughter and repossess mine.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Okay, how do I learn to use them? Now, I know when I start out with binoculars, I was a real moron and all kinds of weird stuff happened.
But you were looking at your neighbors. You weren't looking at birds, right?
Well, okay. So how do I get used to using binoculars?
Well, one of the things that beginners need to learn is how to, what we call it, we say get on the bird, how to keep the bird in your field of view. And it actually takes practice to get pretty good at this. I suggest that people try to learn to get on the bird at a bird feeder. Bird feeders are, I mean, you can sit in your pajamas and drink coffee. You can even sit on your sofa.
That all sounds good to me.
And it's a good way to get started in learning how to get on the bird, because at a bird feeder, you know there's going to be birds there, but they do move around. So the thing you do is you see the bird with your eyes, and then you put the binoculars up to your eyes looking at the bird, and then you adjust the center focus until the bird is in focus. Now, sometimes the bird's moved, but then you can lower them again and do the same thing over again. And what you're never going to want to do is to try and scan for a bird. It just doesn't work very well. So start with the feeder where you know there's going to be a bird on a perch. Then move to looking at birds in the bushes around the feeder. Sometimes it helps to choose a landmark, a broken stick, or something that's in the field of view, because if you lose the bird, then you can go in that general area again.
So far, I think I can do this because there's a sofa and coffee involved, and there's a bird there, too, because I know birds in my bird feeder.
I have suet feeders, and they linger longer.
Yeah, that's right.
At suet feeders, they hang around and try to wrestle the stuff out. That does help me understand why I would get seasick looking for birds. Because I would
be
swiveling through and all this stuff would be winging and swimming past.
Yeah, scanning doesn't work very well. You want to focus on the bird with your eyes and then focus the binoculars on that spot.
So this is helpful. This is really helpful, right?
Yeah. So even when you're out in the wilderness, that's how you have to do it.
That's right.
So I have bird feeders, and there's probably 10 bird species that I can identify at the bird feeder. And people come and say, oh, it's that pretty red bird, and I know. But there's kind of a whole, chain of things you need to do to really do a good identification, right? Is that the way it works? Like you look at the head, or what do you start with?
Well, there's a general technique. The problem is that birds move, you know? They're not going to be in view unless they're sitting at a suet feeder. They're probably not going to be very cooperative, and sometimes they're just not cooperative at all. So on the chance that the bird's going to move, you want to try and make a mental picture of the bird. So it's important to try and look at the things that are important in bird identification. So you want to get some sense of size. Is it the size of a sparrow? Is it the size of a crow? Is it the size of a robin? You want to get some sense of its shape and posture. Does it sit upright like a hawk? Or is it round like a robin and crouched? I try and study the bird from head to tail. I feel I get long enough to do that. Bill shape isn't terribly important in identifying birds because that's how they get their food. So is it hooked like it would be in a raptor? Or is it pointed like it would be in a warbler or something like that? And you also want to look for what we call field marks, things like wing bars or eye stripes or prominent bits of color that's on the bird. That's helpful. And then you want to try and think about what is it doing and what is its habitat. Is it on the water, for example? Or is it in a tree or a bush? Or is it sitting on a wire eating? Is it singing? You know, those sorts of things all help in identifying birds.
So I have all those things. I know the size of it relative to a robin, and I kind of know some field markings and color and habitat. So how do I translate that data that I have now in my head? What do I use then to identify the bird?
Well, you could write that down.
But you don't have to.
It depends on how complicated.
I have sat at my binoculars and just recited all the details.
At first, that's probably a good idea, right?
I think so. It helps you remember it. But then once you've got it in your mind, you need a tool. You need either an identification guide or you need a phone app. And no matter what you use, the identification process is basically a process of winnowing down, eliminating certain ones as possibilities. There's lots of birds to choose from, but which one is actually the one you're looking at? So field guides are bird identification books. There's a whole bunch on the market, and they're all fun to look at and very good. I would suggest going to a bookstore and finding one that you like. You generally buy a field guide for a particular geographic area. So there are field guides to all of North America, the U.S. There's field guides to the eastern United States. There's even field guides to New York State.
You mean like Birding the Hudson Valley?
That's a good one by Catherine Schneider.
Yeah,
my book is not a field guide.
It's not a field guide.
It's still good.
But the thing about buying a guide to a small area like the eastern United States, for example, which is nice because it has a limited number of birds in it, is that when I go to California, I got to buy a new book, right? So if you like to buy books, buy one for a smaller geographic area.
And I assume if you're a starting birder, it probably makes sense to buy one that's more local because then you're not going to have as many things. You're not going to be saying, oh, I think it's this, and it turns out it's a bird that's habitat is somewhere in the western part of the United States, right?
Exactly. And with a field guide, you're going to find your bird by paging through the book. But nowadays, I got to say, I use my field guides primarily as reference tools. I love them. I have lots of them. But I use them at home to read about the birds that I've seen. In the field, I'm actually using my app most of the time.
Okay, so tell us about what apps are great and why they're great and how you use them.
Well, there are lots of apps. Every field guide has an app to go with it now. But the one that I really like for beginners is one called Merlin Bird ID. It's free from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And the great advantage of an app is that you always have your phone with you, but you might forget and leave your field guide home, you know. But it's really portable compared to a book. And there are the other thing about the phone app is that your phone knows things about you. It knows where you are, for example. So it's not, when it comes to identifying the bird, it's not going to tell you birds in California. You're not going to have to eliminate those birds. It knows the date. And if you give it just a little bit more information, Merlin can actually identify the bird for you by answering 5 questions.
That sounds pretty simple.
I want to get a Merlin on wheels and just send it out in the field.
Although it's also a little scary because it's kind of tracking where you are and what you're doing, right?
That's true.
Yeah. Does it also identify the time of year, or do you have to put that in?
Like, no, that's in there. You have to put the date in. You have to put in location and date, but you know your phone knows that. So it's simply a matter of clicking on it.
So somebody developed this who's a birder, right? Because they figured out, like, here are the 5 questions I need to ask. Very cool.
So you have to put in location. You have to put in date. The next thing is actually a judgment on your part. You have to identify the size of the bird. So Merlin asks you to choose between, you know, there's a scale. Is it robin size? Is it sparrow size? Is it goose size? So you give it an approximate size. It asks you for the 3 main colors. So you have to make some judgments here. You have to decide what the main colors are on the bird. And then what was it doing? Is it eating at a feeder? Is it on the ground? Is it in trees or bushes? These are pretty simple judgments to make. Is it soaring?
Is this multiple choice?
Yes, it is multiple
Thank
choice.
God.
Yeah.
But that's all you have to do. You put those 5 answers in, and it shows you pictures. And you get to choose. You can scroll through a bunch of pictures and choose which one is your bird.
And I assume it's pretty accurate, and there aren't that many pictures to choose from, right? Or
usually not that many. Yeah, usually.
Because you've narrowed it down, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. But I should also mention that one of the most amazing things about this Merlin Bird ID, aside from the fact that it's really great and free, is that in the last couple of years, they have also added a sound ID.
Oh, we love this.
We
love
do. We this, play with right? that all we, the time.
This is my favorite thing about the Merlin Bird
So you can just hold your phone up, have the phone listen to the bird, and it'll tell you what it's singing.
With pictures.
And the thing that's so cool about that is that a lot of times you don't see the bird, right? You walk out on your front porch, and you're hearing, but you're not seeing, so you can. It's so cool, right?
Well, it's amazingly accurate. I mean, it does make an occasional mistake, but not very many. And what I found is really amazing. It can identify woodpeckers by tapping, which I cannot do sometimes. Wow. And it can identify baby birds when they're begging, which I cannot do sometimes. So it's better birder than me.
Do you have any concept for kind of how they've developed this?
No. It's a technical, in my book, it's a technological wonder.
I mean, I assume that they have a huge amount of data that they've collected, and they're kind of using all of that to as a stew to kind of pull from.
Well, didn't we visit? We went to Cornell, the Master Gardeners, and visited the bird lab out there, and it's phenomenal.
Well, they have the Library of Natural Sound out there, but the fact that they can eliminate car noise and they can eliminate me talking in the background, I think is just amazing. And honestly, it's getting more sophisticated that they're starting to develop these devices that they can put in the woods to listen for birds and identify them, which means you're not even going to need people to do field work anymore. You're just going to put a receiver out in the woods, and they're going to be able to sample the wildlife that's out
there. Well, and I think the thing that really impressed me was it might be listing, so you're standing out there for 5 minutes, and so there's 10 birds, but then when a bird sings, it actually highlights it so you know it's singing, right? So it's not the cardinal above, it's the whatever bobolink that is singing at that moment.
I just had a terrible thought.
What?
It's getting so technical and so advanced.
It's not, though.
Do you think, well, no, it's wonderful, but do you think at some point it's going to be able to tell us what the birds are saying about us? Wouldn't that be cool?
I think it'll be a while. Okay. I do think it'll be a while.
You'll be dead, Jean.
I will not.
So I know you can see a limited number of birds at your feeder, you know, with me with my feet up on the coffee table. So I guess I have to venture out there if I want to see more birds. So how do I start to do that?
Well, you can increase the diversity at your feeder in a number of ways by changing the foods and locations and things like that. But eventually you're going to plateau out and there won't be any new birds unless the season changes a lot. And even then, you're going to meet a maximum of what you can see at your feeder. So you need to go beyond the feeder. You're never going to see a bald eagle at your feeder, and they're all over the Hudson Valley. People are usually thrilled to see them. You need to go out birding. You need to leave your yard, and you need to visit different habitats at different times of the year to see more birds. I think people sometimes don't realize that the birds are really amazingly fine-tuned physiologically. They have a very, very high metabolic rate. They have a higher body temperature than you and I do, and this is because they're very active. Therefore, they have to be active foragers. They have to keep fueling their bodies with food. Food is absolutely essential for them to keep going because everything they do demands energy. So they're outside in freezing temperatures with no clothes on at all. Imagine if you were outside.
I know, I feel badly for them. Should I feel badly for them?
No, because they have these amazing feathers. Feathers are wonderful insulators, but they do have to keep eating. I mean, you can't keep heat in if you don't have the energy to create the heat in the first place. So they're amazing insulators, and the birds that are here now are the ones that are able to find enough food to be able to keep warm. So in winter, they do things like eat seed, for example, or if they're insectivores, they eat some seed and maybe dormant insects like pupae and eggs, for example. They eat leftover food that's still around, like sumac, or maybe they're predators. So maybe they're things like hawks, which you can still find mice and voles and things like that in winter. So the things that are here now are the ones that are able to find food. Some birds actually cache food. Maybe you've seen a red-bellied woodpecker or a nuthatch take a seed from the feeder and pound it into a crack in a tree. That's another way of making it through the winter. Have a storehouse of food just like a squirrel does. But the days are short, so they have to be extremely efficient at finding food during daylight hours if they're diurnal birds. So the nice thing is that spring will eventually come. And when spring comes, the days get longer. The birds that migrated because they couldn't find food here during the winter because the insects are all dead, but they start to come back in the spring. And they're going to take advantage of the changes in the seasons.
Okay, so I just had an epiphany. Depending on time of year, you're going to have different assortments of birds to look at. Well, for a rookie, that's a big deal.
That is an epiphany.
Well, yeah. Spring is the most wonderful time of the year for us birders.
Well, you're seeing things that don't necessarily stay here that are passing through,
right? All those birds that eat insects, the pretty warblers and the orioles and the grosbeaks, I mean, those guys can't make it through the winter here. Their insects are dead, and they're not big on dormant insects. So they migrate. They go south for the winter. So now food becomes available, and the days are longer. There's more time to do other stuff, time for doing things like finding a mate or singing or defending a territory or building a nest or laying eggs or doing all those things that birds do during the breeding season. But that's why the breeding season is when it is. It's because there's time to not forage and to do those other things. There's enough energy to do all those other activities.
I assume these birds evolved over time to kind of, and there were certain insects that they're looking for. Has climate change really kind of thrown a monkey wrench into all of this? Because there's probably insects out earlier, right? And and plants are probably blooming earlier. And I mean, is that something that we're worried about?
Climate change is a big topic, but we've definitely seen changes in the patterns of bird migration. Tree swallows are coming back earlier than they used to. Some insectivore, these are the birds that eat insects, some of those populations have declined. We're basically worried about insect population levels and their impacts on birds.
So birds are coming back too early?
Well, so things like tree swallows, which are feeding on insects in the air, as soon as it gets warm, there's more insects in the air, but they get caught by a cold snap, and I found more than one dead tree swallow in a box that can't make it through a early spring snowstorm because there's no food to eat.
So they're kind of responding to the insects coming back early, and then if there's a dip in temperature, they just can't deal with it.
And of course, that's the way natural selection works. You would assume that those birds that came back too early and died would be selected against. So food is really incredibly important to birds. They have to have enough to eat at the right time of year. I tell people if they want to see more birds, the important thing to do is to learn where they live and what they eat. most of these birds aren't going to live around your bird feeder. So I can give you some examples of some of the birds that you might see if you ventured beyond your bird feeder. So say there's birds that are eating seeds that are not just seeds at your bird feeder. If you want to see birds in winter that are eating seeds, one of the things you need to think about is where the seeds are. So, for example, there are snow buntings and hornlarks around here that we don't have other times of the year. They're birds of the far north. And to them, the Hudson Valley is like the Bahamas, you know? So they're here, and they're finding seeds. And where they're finding seeds is where the seed heads of weeds and such poke up through the snow. The birds like juncos, for example, which also eat seeds at your feeder, those guys, you're going to see large flocks of juncos along the edges of roads where the snow plows have come along and scraped the edge of the road, and there's lots of seeds available in those areas. So wherever they're going to find seeds, that's where you're going to see the birds. There are waterfowl around here in winter. Waterfowl get most of their nutrients out of the water. So if you want to see things like ducks and geese, which are just, the ducks especially, are starting to move back to this area now, you want to find places where there's open water. If it's frozen, they can't get their food. But in the middle of winter, there are large areas that are frozen and only a few areas that have open water. And that's where you want to look for waterfowl. Fruit eaters, I mean, certain birds are big on fruit. Everybody thinks robins eat worms, and they mostly feed those worms to their babies. Bluebirds and robins and cedar waxwings, they are around here this time of year, and they're primarily fruit eaters in winter. Now, it's getting towards the end of the winter, but we still have some sumac and crabapple left. And those are the kinds of foods that they're going to be eating. So if you can find a tree with crabapple, you might find birds on it this time of year.
And kind of the inverse of that, I assume, and I know that we've talked about this kind of off podcast, right? Mm-hmm. If you're planting things in your own yard, you want to plant not just things that are fruiting in the fall, but also things that kind of retain their fruit. The late winter, early spring is like a really tough time, right? Because there's very little left.
That's right. It's a very tough time.
That's what I always think about, like aronias, like that are very, very astringent winter berries that maybe the birds aren't eating in the fall, but they'll eat like in the late winter, right?
That's right. They need them to freeze and thaw and freeze and thaw and get soft and a little bit fermented, and they will eat them as the winter progresses. So, native things are so much better than, I mean, what they've got bittersweet left in the woods. And I got to tell you, the birds don't like bittersweet much. You walk along, you can see bittersweet all over the ground and nobody's touched it.
So you have to really think about planting things that support the birds throughout the whole season, not just the summer and spring, but also the winter, right?
Yeah, there are whole books on this. There's lots of really good stuff out there.
And maybe we'll include some links.
You have to know what bird you're looking for before you plant stuff.
Or birds, right?
In general. I mean, there are lots of different birds that belong in all these different categories. I mean, for example, I have some friends that want to see predators in winter. So they want to see hawks and eagles. So they collect roadkill and put it in their yard.
Okay. strangeness of birders, so, I guess is true.
So they can watch the bald eagles from their window.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do things like that.
Oh, so I can lay on the couch and see a bald eagle.
That's right.
So that is proof to be
untrue. As long as you're willing
untrue.
To collect roadkill, yes. Well,
Tim needs a bigger window.
I don't think so. So what other advice do you have to give to starting birders?
I have just two things that I think might help a lot. The most important thing is to go out and look for birds. Get off your couch, Tim, and actually go walk in the woods a bit or walk in a grassland or someplace where you don't usually go. You can do it alone. You can learn. I think actually it's fairly important to do some birding alone because you can teach yourself a lot. But it helps an awful lot to go with a group of birders, basically a whole bunch of mentors that can help you learn more about birds and tell you if you're right. I mean, affirmation is really important. Otherwise, you learn things wrong. There are bird clubs everywhere in the world, basically, but here in the Hudson Valley, there are bird clubs that hold field trips year-round. They go out on weekends, and they always welcome people who are not members of the club. All you have to do is check their websites for when they have field trips and show up at the appointed time and place. And you'll have a whole group of people that will be more than happy to teach you everything they know about birds. That's one thing about birders is they love to share their knowledge and to teach other people.
And I know I went out with one of your bird clubs and knew nothing, and they were super welcoming. They were really nice. The only rule, and I know this is a rule that Gene and I can't usually follow, is you have to be quiet, right? You have talk the whole time.
If you're going to chatter, at least hang out in the back of the group.
So no talking.
Because
no
a lot talking. Of really good birds are trying to hear birds and to identify birds by sound These tiny little chip notes are really important in helping us find birds, and we can't hear them when people are talking. I'd also encourage you to start writing down what you see. There are lots of different ways to keep data. You don't have to become a lister, but I think most people are interested in keeping a list of what they see at their bird feeders. You can actually record these lists on a computer program that Cornell puts out there for free. It's called eBird. It's much easier than writing it in a notebook. The nice thing about eBird is that once you start recording birds in eBird, it will generate a list for you. You can ask it, you know, what birds did I normally see in winter? What birds do I normally see in June? And it will create all kinds of lists for you. But the thing about writing down what you see is that it helps you recognize your mistakes. It helps you remember what you've already learned. And the seasonality of birding becomes important. You see different birds at certain times of the year, and that will become obvious once you start to record your data.
That's like my husband. He knew when it was spring when the first red-winged blackbird showed up,
and he would always mark
the date.
Mm-hmm. Well, and all the birds start sounding a little bit different in spring, right? I mean, I think that, what is it, the chickadees that have
they start singing their songs instead of just doing their call notes.
Right.
That baby is their courtship song, and the chickadee-dee-dee is I'm just annoyed with you, basically. And
I hear that one a lot.
Yeah, but that's me. The Carolina wrens this year seem to be very vocal.
Sing all winter, but they get really excited in the spring.
Yeah.
And their song is like five times as big as they are. I adore them.
Yeah. So you've convinced me to go out. Are there particular habitats that you would recommend?
Well, I'd certainly visit a wetland. I'd visit a nice wetland because you'll see more than just red-winged blackbirds there if you watch carefully. There are really nice wetlands in both Columbia and Greene counties. One that I like in Columbia County is the Lewis Swire Preserve on Mill Creek. It's just south of Skodak along the river. That is actually a freshwater tidal swamp, so it's got a bunch of really interesting birds. And in Greene County here, Vosburgh Swamp is really nice, so you see a lot of ducks there as well. I would visit a grassland. There are some wonderful grasslands that are not mowed that have bobolinks in them, and many other grassland specialists like the Ooms Conservation Area in Columbia County. At Sutherland Pond is a really terrific place to go. You can't miss the bobolinks there, but there's also savannah sparrows and lots of other open country birds.
And that's a summer, like spring, summer?
They'll get here in May. Okay, they're away now, but it's a nice grassland in winter, but you'll see a lot more in the summer. I think it's good to try and visit some high elevation sites. Lots of people climb mountains or go to the tops of hills and don't realize that they're actually in a different habitat. In Greene County, you have real boreal habitat. You can go all the way to Hunter Mount. It's a nice hike. It's only about a mile and a half, and even I can do it at my advanced age. It has things like black poles, for example, and there's a thrush up there, the bicknell thrush, which is a very rare bird, but bicknell thrush has been seen on the top of Hunter Mountain. But you can even see some higher elevation birds at relatively low elevations in Columbia County, at places like Beebe Hill and Harvey Mountain. You'll see different birds on the tops of those big hills.
So it's not just the habitat, it's the elevation. That's really interesting.
Yeah, well, there's different plants to go along with it, so... And there are, of course, we have woodlands everywhere, but not all woods are the same. But the nice thing about woodlands, especially in the summer, is that's where you can see warblers. The warblers they're woodland birds. I love Olana in Columbia County. I mean, it's easy to walk around that place because the carriage roads are pretty level. I think the Mountaintop Arboretum in Greene County is wonderful for seeing warblers. There's lots of different kinds of habitats at the Mountaintop Arboretum, including some pretty high elevations.
And when's the kind of time period for warblers in our area? Is it like May through June? Or
you can see warblers whenever it's warm here, but May is the best time of the year because in May we get the migrants that pass through to the Adirondacks and don't breed here, but we also get our resident warblers.
So I have to take time from my planting to go out and see warblers. So.
That is one of the worst problems, being a gardener and a birder.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time I've done my birding in the morning, I'm sometimes too tired to do my gardening in the afternoon.
So for the rookie birder who can leave their garden, best time of day is early?
Especially in summer. I mean, during the winter, I don't think it matters that much. Though birds have, of course, been fasting all night long, so they're hungry first thing in the morning, and they tend to be active. But the thing about the summer is that it's hot in the afternoon, and believe it or not, it costs energy to stay cool as well. So they're going to want to sit in the shade and pant and not be out foraging. So when it's hot, you tend not to see as many birds. That's tougher on the humans, too. So I think early in the morning's best most times of the year.
It's more comfortable for everybody.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
This has been just terrific. I mean, I feel like I've learned so much. How about you, Jane?
Yeah, we thought we knew stuff, but we're not even close.
We're so far off. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it, Kathy.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Linnell and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.